Hey, and welcome to FutureThinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to FutureThinkers.org/start.
Hey everyone, our guest today is Jamie Wheel, a researcher and coach in the field of human potential, peak performance, and flow states. He is the co-author of the book Stealing Fire and the director of Flow Genome Project.
In this episode, we talk about how to make sense in a world that is unraveling faster than what we can keep up with. And we discuss some potential solutions to this crisis and also the challenges of building coherent and resilient communities. To get all the links and show notes for this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/100. And by the way, this is our 100th episode. All right, let's dive in.
Check out our new course in personal evolution. Part one is on cultivating sovereignty and is designed to support you in developing more clarity about your direction and purpose in life, making better decisions, and having more agency to live your life on your own terms.
Part two is on integrating the shadow and is designed to support you in overcoming nihilism and tapping into an inner source of energy, creativity, and wisdom to make meaningful progress towards actualizing your full potential. To learn more, go to courses.futurethinkers.org.
Jamie, welcome to the show. It's really great to have you. We've had a lot of your content we've been consuming at home lately. We just got through Stealing Fire, which I know we've already kind of pre-discussed. We're going to go into new territory from there. We've watched your interviews on Rebel Wisdom. Really fascinating stuff. Love the conversation with Daniel and Jordan. So we want to take the conversation in new places today. So let's maybe start with sense making on a collective scale.
Yeah. I mean, bottom line is, I don't know what your experience has been, but it seems like kind of crazy times these days. And it feels like there's been a palpable uptick in sort of both novelty, complexity, and consequence, even in the last 6 months. So, you know, like if I rewound the clock to like, what was I thinking? I mean, even when I wrote my book proposal for the sequel to Stealing Fire, right? And that was about 18 months to 12 months ago and submitted it. I was making the argument, right? That, hey, we're overwhelmed and we're tired, wired, stressed, anxious, depressed, suicidal. That's a public health issue. Why are we having the public health issue? Here's all the reasons. We're overwhelmed with information and we're starving for inspiration. Oh, by the way, there's these substantial and significant dynamics of, you know, rats leaving the sinking ship, you know, with kind of like doomsday preppers for the super rich and luxury nuclear bunkers and, you know, colonizing New Zealand and all this stuff. And at the time it seemed super edgy. And I had to like persuade my agent in New York and persuade my book publisher, like, no, this is a thing. Like, I think it's really a thing. Like, and it'll probably be true by 3 to 5 years from now. And now I'm, you know, sitting down in the actual writing of the book and having to basically just discard the first third. You're like, oh, this is just table stakes now. And it's in everybody's newsfeed. I do not need to relitigate any of that. It's already happened. And in fact, I need to take that third of, you know, whatever it is, 25,000 words, and actually put it at the end of the book and actually start trying to pave the way further forward. So my sense is that there is a quickening of complexity and consequence right now.
Why do you think that is? What has picked up speed recently in the conversation?
Well, I mean, there's a bunch of things. I mean, one, we are, you know, 2 to 3 years into this current executive leadership of this country, and the dismantling of basically the sort of neoliberal Pax Americana, you know, so like that sort of American peace that really prevailed more or less uninterruptedly from the close of World War II until now. And we are literally unwinding everything from NATO to the kind of neoliberal globalist promise. There's a lot of really places where I think there's been a sort of collapse in benign authority. So, and the closest I can think of to this is sort of the years like 1968 to 72, you know, where you had MLK, you know, RFK, you had the assassinations of our kind of last iconic positive leaders. You had the revolutions around the world in 68. You had the protest. You then had Watergate, Pentagon Papers, Kent State, you had that whole kind of implosion. But when you think about that, as pivotal as that was, and as much as that shaped the next decade plus, I mean, it's effectively what gave us the Reagan-Thatcher era to come after it, right? That's kind of a drop in the bucket to what we're looking at now with the absolute pervasive collapse in benign authority. So you're like, well, my doctor is on my side, right? He took the Hippocratic Oath and he wears that white coat. But then you're like, oh, actually, our dearest doctors for the last 20 years have been prescribing us OxyContin because they went on golfing trips and got kickbacks. And big pharma, like we literally have the opioid crisis is because our doctors and our medical providers and then the entire legislative establishment that enabled it, including the DEA, actually got it badly wrong. And we're now facing the opioid crisis. So you're like that. Then you take a look at business and you're like, well, hey, you know, literally like that HBO show, Silicon Valley, you know, had it as a punchline 5 years ago that every pitch at TechCrunch would end with, and we're going to make the world a better place, right? And that was a joke because it was so cliche. But now like the FANG stocks, you know, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google, right, are no longer simply seen as, oh, look at Larry and Sergey, and they've got scooters and bouncy balls, and they serve everybody gourmet food. Isn't this amazing? They're now seen as, whoa, wait a second. You guys were selling contracts to the Pentagon for AI facial recognition. You guys are gutting, you know, Amazon is gutting our local tax base and economies and destroying great retail. And at the same time, your shareholders just voted down an employee-driven effort to reduce your carbon footprint and, once again, not sell weaponized big data and facial recognition tech. You know, you're like, oh, shit. So even the idealistic Silicon Valley side is really creaking. You know, Facebook and its privacy and Cambridge Analytica. You can take a look at all of these and you're like, whoops. You know, like, sorry, was this just late-stage capitalism wrapped in a silicon chip layer and said, pay no attention to what the cap table looks like. Pay no attention to where the massive money grab is. This is the new sharing economy. And there's a whole sense of kind of like, whoops. And even in conventional business, you kind of think of the two bastions of, you know, respectability and impeccable aspirational goals is Goldman Sachs and McKinsey. And McKinsey has been complicit in the entire, basically, you know, state capture rape of South Africa and their finances. McKinsey with the 1DB or 1MDB, the Singapore scandal has been 100% caught, hands in the till. And of course, they're blaming it on a couple of rogue partners and all this kind of stuff. And everybody kind of moves along, but you're like, holy smokes. Where, who and what is trustable these days? Throw in the Ivy League admission scandals and you're like, holy shit. Like there is a, you know, not only are we kind of in a post truth kind of world and fake news and all the stuff we're all aware of, but I think we really are seeing, a sense of abandonment and a sense of rising kind of, you know, rage is the most extreme expression of it, but at a minimum, extreme disenchantment. Is anybody actually standing behind what they say and what they say they are and do? And are any of our interests truly being looked after? So, you know, the fancy term would be the collapse of the neoliberal globalist promise. I think it's what fuels Steve Bannon and all the right wing movements, in Europe. And I think weirdly, it also portends other things to come. In the sense that, like, if you took our current administration and the sort of rabid fears of pressure from the borders and, you know, even where John Cleese has been getting flack, you know, the kind of the Brexit anti-immigrationist, anti-London stuff, they're not wrong. They're just early and helping destabilize and bring about sooner than it actually had to real crises for nationality, democracy, and the carrying capacity of free market democracies to support civil society. So like give us 10 years and 10x the number of refugees coming from South and Central America, right? And America absolutely has the crisis that alt-right nativists are discussing. The question is, what do we do with it? And the question that Cleese and others have been voicing regarding the dilution versus assimilation into British civil society isn't wrong either when you say, hey, like, it's not okay to come to a country and simply take what is, you know, its largesse without buying into the civil experiment that it, you know, without buying into its ideals and value sets. That is actually problematic. And as long as progressives on the left only see racism and nativism on the right, we miss being able to persuade the middle that you are feeling something that's legit, but actually there are more pro-social, more humanitarian, more aspirational and idealistic ways to deal with it. So, I mean, that's a random scattershot of just kind of the pulse of things right now. Yeah. And that's in the civil socio-political sector. Then throw in the biggest change that I've noticed in existential risk conversations is it's not that this information hasn't been around for decades if you're in an academic specialty or have opted into the conversations. And so like my academic background was historical anthropology, so kind of Guns, Germs, and Steel meets Sapiens, with an emphasis on environmental history. Like, what is the relationship of human civilization to the natural environment over millennia? So for me, this stuff was way early. This was 20 years ago. I'm like, oh, hey, we're a hydraulic society. You know, everything west of the 100th meridian in America, like west of the Mississippi, is on borrowed time. And you look at every hydraulic society from Egypt to the Anasazi, you know, to the Incans, you know, this is how it goes. So like we're on a, you know, and you're piping all the water to LA from the, you know, the east side of the Sierras. None of that shit works. So you can take the long view, but if you've been watching it lately, the thing that I think is, you know, noteworthy in a very sobering way, is where the signal is showing up. It's no longer in specialty publications. It's no longer in fringe conversations. It's in the New York Times. You know, the New York, just like a month ago, there was just a little piece on the Pinkerton Detective Agency. And it was kind of like, I mean, it wasn't, I wouldn't say it was glib or folksy, but it was more casual than I think the actual content would suggest, where it was like, hey, the Pinkertons, the folks that used to, you know, guard wagon trains in the crazy ass Wild West, because there was no law and authority. They were hired gun mercenaries. You know, they were the ones that hunted down Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. You know, the Pinkertons are back, but this time they're positioning themselves as a global strategic consultancy, kind of like Deloitte, you know, packing heat. And they are working directly with high net worth families and the executives of global companies, planning and managing and guaranteeing anticipatory safety and protection and extrication from when the shit hits the fan. And you're like, whoa, like that's a crazy ass canary in a coal mine. And then you have things like Bill McKibben's new book, and it's showing up in Rolling Stone, or Jared Diamond's completion to his trilogy of Guns, Germs, Steel, Collapse, and now Upheaval. You know, and you're just seeing it all. You can't hide from it. You know, Vice magazine publishing that Australian report, which, you know, has some counters and critiques, but nonetheless, it's showing up in Vice and Vox and New York Times and Rolling Stone. And I mean, at least for me, I can't even hide from it if I wanted to. It's just like wet fish, whack, whack. And you're like, okay, things are getting real very quickly. So that's, and we can unpack where I think that the personal challenges are in making sense of this, but let me pause there because that was a fair amount of initial framework.
Yeah, I think the personal challenges is going to be an interesting question to unpack, because it's something that everybody can relate to. You know, the not being able to escape the stuff, not being able to deny it if they were maybe trying to before.
There's now also that everywhere. Problem of establishing signal from noise here. Like, and you kind of brought up an interesting point in the middle of that, which was that some people seem to be almost trying to advance this conversation as a trying to address some of the problems early, I suppose, like almost like a canary in the coal mine. Like, ratchet up the fear so that people will respond quicker. And in some way, I mean, I've thought about this a lot for the conversations of existential risk that we've had, that people will not move until their situation is too painful to do anything else. Right. So do you think that's what the situation is when we're talking about like the post-truth society that we live in? Is everything that's being discussed right now so urgent? What are the urgent things, and what part of the conversation is not really or maybe a little too early?
Well, I mean, literally, like, this is 2 days worth of intense conversation, mapping and tracking. Yeah. But I think that there's several things that I'm noticing. The first is, well, I'll just kind of take it from the top on, like, how do we, just as people, you know, like with me, myself, my loved ones, family, close friends, how do we even sort through all this stuff? Because it's crazy making. Yeah. And most people, even well-intentioned, will lean into it, get completely overwhelmed, enter shit or go blind territory, and then collapse and withdraw.
Yeah.
And so even if, like, just check your own system right now, like on an interoceptive level, like, how are you feeling listening to this conversation? Is it light and engaged? Is it churny? Is it sort of vigilant? Like what's going on, and what do I need to pay attention to? Like, let's just even just track thus far. How does this stuff land in our nervous system? Because I gave a talk just last week at a conference in Austin, and I was the opening keynote. So it's kind of a, you know, it was a fairly high impact place to like set things up. And I really felt, and this was on the heels of that Australian climate report and a bunch of other things that had recently been happening in the prior, say, month. And I was like, oh shit, I think I actually, like, to be in integrity, I sure as hell can't stand up and be like, rah, rah, rah. You know, like flow and biohacking and psychedelic renaissance, like woohoo, you know, like that wasn't going to feel remotely congruent. And I was like, well, what is the thing that actually I'm compelled to say? And can I do it as lovingly, joyfully, skillfully as possible? And I bombed. I was like, guys, I've been avoiding getting up and delivering this lecture, this talk for 20 years. I can't anymore. And in the what felt for me very painful, very kind of like vulnerable blowback of like, oh shit, like shoot the messenger. You know, like people did not want to hear it. They wanted to talk about blockchain and rad shit and like cool tech. And I was like, hey guys, I think we really have to rip the bandaid off here.
And this is quite a recent conversation, you said, right?
Yeah. This was a couple of weeks ago. And for me, that there's several things. I mean, one is, to take it from the top, because like this pain, like the dissonance I felt from this actually was really productive, because I like noodled on it for the rest of the weekend. And this is what I came up with, which is the ability for us to accurately diagnose and act on what is happening in the world right now is constrained by at least three things. The first is our complexity, like literally developmentally, what is the operating system we're running? Because it is super easy with cognitive biases, heuristic traps, right? Immersions in our stories, inability to hold conflicting ideas or paradoxes simultaneously and split the difference between them, right? There's a whole lot of capacities to make sense that only come online once you're running a sophisticated enough operating system. And so if you go over to like Bob Keegan's work in developmental psychology at Harvard, et cetera, it's a stage of complexity, right? That is, you know, relatively rare, probably say less than, you know, 5 to 10% of the population holds it in the first place. Now, that said, I don't think that's persistent. I think the more really folks with the capacity can make sense of it and provide scaffolded, structured experiences for others to see. And the moment there's footprints to follow, it becomes much, much easier for others to also go in those ways if they feel good and true for them. But operational complexity is step one, non-negotiable for now. Step two is what are your cognitive biases? What are your sacred cows? What are the narratives or sense-making for yourself, for your community, for society, for reality that you take a priori for granted? And that then informed, you know, or Thomas Kuhn's paradigms, right? Scientific revolution shit. So what is paradigmatic for you and you are unwilling or unable to notice and challenge? And so that might be things like, I believe that free market democracy is the pinnacle of social development and there isn't anything better. Like, this is it. I believe the market is the best way to innovate versus governmental interventions. I believe that America truly is exceptional and is destined for its role in endless progress. I believe that the universe is unfolding according to a benign and perfect plan, and all we need to do is surrender to it. I believe that psychedelics or baby Jesus or a technological singularity or something nonlinear is going to intervene and is going to save us. It could be DAO stack blockchain, right? Fill in the blank, but something nonlinear that is salvatory, right? And so we can go through all of these lists and realize, okay, we're all holding on to certain initial perceptions and positions. And until we become subject object aware of them, meaning I'm not just in it and I take it as reality, but I can actually point at it, name it, discuss it, and I'm not hijacked by it, the whole goldfish in the water thing. Until I'm at that stage, my sense making is going to be fucked because I have to actually right now be able to hold all sorts of highly destabilizing, unsettling possibilities that are contradictory simultaneously. And if you think about it, like we've already, you know, millennials have already given up basically on the idea that car ownership, home ownership, and early family are the markers of adulting.
Yep.
Many baby boomers have had to give up on retiring at 55 with a gold watch and a good pension plan, right? We're seeing the death of narrative all over the place. We're all adjusting and adapting, even career path, like the idea there's a corporate ladder anymore. Nope. You know, there's a freelance temp gig economy pyramid. And, you know, there's all these kind of things. There was even a fascinating story on the anniversary of, I think it was Reality Bites, that cult classic movie with like Winona Ryder and Ethan Hawke. And it was like one of the definitive like slacker Gen X stories. But it was a really good think piece saying how that idea that the notion, and I think Ben Stiller was like the corporate guy who was going to get the girl or not. And the idea was like, indie guys aren't sellouts. They never sell out. That's what's core, you know, versus in contrasting that with like Instagram influencer culture, where everybody is whoring their carefully curated lifestyles and makes no bones about it. Like, how did we even get to that? Right. And, you know, 10 years ago, it was like Paris Hilton, the girl who's famous for being famous, you know, and like that was a novelty. And then that label got attached to Kim Kardashian and to start with, like, this is so crazy. And then her, you know, her younger siblings, like the first self-made billionaire. And you're like, holy shit, like this is a progression. So that brings us to level three. So the first one is operational complexity or the consciousness. How much can I hold at subject object awareness? Next is your sacred cows. How many of those are you willing to shoot in order to be able to consider what must be considered? And then the third one, which is, you know, directly informs the others, is our ability to digest our grief.
Yep.
I was hoping you were going to get to this because I was going to ask if facing the shadow in the Jungian sense would be the kind of relation to step two, but I guess that would be the third.
Yeah, because like if I can't handle the death of all my sacred cows, of all my dreams, of all my future happy plans, of the way the world works, if I can't handle that, I'll go into denial. So I'll reject metabolizing my grief that way. Alternately, if I wade into this and I just end up in existential nihilistic despair, I get crushed by my grief. And so both of those are, you know, needless to say, decompensated responses. And so ideally, we must, you know, so this is not really even optional or encouraging, like we must get to the place where, like Wendell Berry talks about, he's got a beautiful line in one of his poems. He says, be joyful though you have considered all the facts. And so, right. So that is, you know, and then juxtapose that with like that Oliver Wendell Holmes thing of like, I don't care a damn for the simplicity on this side of complexity, but I'd give my life for the simplicity on the other side of complexity. Right. And so in some respects, I think that there's a ton of people that would even self-identify as super progressive, super conchy culture that are going for, they're actually in just fucking elaborate denial right now. Yeah. and they're doing their cacao ceremonies, sound bus, psychedelic trips, Burning Man, transformational festivals, you name it, they're doing it. And they're pursuing the joy on this side of the grief.
Yep.
Right? Not getting through all the complexity and all the grieving and then coming out as basically Gnostic warriors. Right? Which is, we need samurai right now. We need the person who has meditated on the thousand ways they could die. So they are free from fear and can face it courageously. And so when we go through those three things, those three steps of operating system, kill your sacred cows, digest your grief, show the fuck up. I realize that there's this unique thing where there's like three generations of humans only ever, and only a tiny but concentrated and influential portion of the world, period, that is ever subject to our specific pathologies. And it's basically baby boomers, Gen Xers, and millennials in the developed West. So the folks that have basically, you know, if you think back to our grandparents' generation, or I was even just listening to Gabor Mate, right? I mean, Gabor Mate with Tim was being interviewed by Tim Ferriss. And he was describing being born in 1944 in Budapest and what that was like with the Nazis actually still hunting Jews then. And then crazy right-wing dictatorships and the Russians. And like, that was his experience. My father as a kid was full of like Chronicles of Narnia, man. They were hiding under their kitchen table during the London Blitz and then got shipped off to a boarding school in Scotland that had no, you know, had frozen water in the bath, in the wash basins in the morning. You're like, that's one generation back from many of our families. So it's really only boomers, Xers, millennials that have been raised in the sense of you can have anything you want. Everybody can grow up to be president. Every family, the kids live in bigger and better lives of opulence and material comfort. And the world, the only problem to solve is kind of our bourgeois neurotic unease. That's it. Everything else, man, sky's the goddamn limit. And you realize that like, and again, developed West, because there's tons of people around the world that that is a distant, luxurious mirage for. So it feels like we've been infantilized. If you take like Tim Wu, like the Columbia media theorist and badass, you know, who coined net neutrality, right? We mentioned him in Stealing Fire because he talked about information technologies and platforms, but he's also done brilliant work on the basically sort of atomization or fragmentation of consumer, hyper individualist society. So we basically created a bunch of entitled narcissistic zoo animals just waiting to be fed the next dopamine hit, right? And we just have to like rip that band-aid off and be like, sack the fuck up, humans. It was a good run. It was a really good run. And we're all needed at full strength to do what must be done. So that notion of like courage and sacrifice, I mean, even Maslow, right? I mean, you guys probably know this, but like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, he died before he published the actual top of the stack. So it wasn't self-actualization, which is what guided the entire baby boomer me generation. It's almost like we've got echo boomers and mini me's, right? So like the me generation, we're getting a resurgence of that in the millennial culture. And Maslow's point was, it's not about your own perfectibility. The next phase is self-transcendence, where you are in service. And it feels like that part, like adding that back to the pyramid and really saying, if you're going through your personal growth and development, awesome, but we don't get to luxuriate here. We don't get to dawdle in the poppy fields like Dorothy, right? Or in the land of lotus eaters like Odysseus. We got to like smack ourselves silly, remember what we're here for, and keep going.
What I'm really interested here is how much the conversation has changed from Stealing Fire to now, because you said in that last talk, you've been avoiding giving this talk for a long time. So what has changed for you in this?
Because obviously, well, I mean, really, Stealing Fire was very optimistic and somewhat utopian, where, you know, like these altered states can save us all.
Uh-huh. Well, actually, okay. So now I'll give you the cheat codes to Stealing Fire. So basically it was a bitter pill wrapped in sugar. Because if you actually take a look, like many people will read that book and be like, oh my God, thank you so much. I'm microdosing because of you. And I'm like, oh, that's not what we said. And then other people are like, hey, I got my dad high. It was awesome. And I'm like, that's not what we said either. We said, hey, there has been for all of creation, a cat and mouse game between the priests and the Prometheans, right? And there's always the people trying to bring light to humanity. And there's always the forces of dark looking to control it or shut it down. It has ever been thus, right? From ancient Greece through MK Ultra, right? And CIA projects. And even, you know, we said, hey, our worst enemies are weaponization, commercialization, and hedonization, right? Our own worst impulses. So it can either be taken over by state or non-state actors, or it can be co-opted to sell us more shit, right? Just Soma 101, Brave New World, or we put it in the ditch all by ourselves. And these are structural dynamics, including the idea of like Tim Wu's master switch thesis, which was if we take ecstatic techniques as an information technology, which you could make, I think, a fairly clear case, they should at least be considered that way, then they will should behave according to the persistent historical pattern of it always starts out utopian and it's going to change the world and it always ends up hegemonic and centrally controlled. So unless we want that to happen, folks, the only solution that we think is possible is to open source the tools for self-realization, community connection, and healing ahead of all the efforts to co-opt it for darker ends and be a bunch of, you know, this is the Rebel Alliance. Like that's the only hope we have is if we can publish the plans for the Death Star, right? And the tools for our own liberation. So like that was the actual thesis, you know, for those who could read it. And that's why in discussing Burning Man, I went super light on, yay, isn't it neat? And isn't it cool? And look at all the art and this and that. It was like, hey, Burners Without Borders. Hey, Hurricane Katrina, war in Afghanistan, right? What we're looking at is ways that people can create coherent communities that are resilient and anti-fragile in the face of collapse of civil society or the absolute absence of civil society. So like those were all the Easter eggs going, hey, like if you want to follow this stuff up, that's the actual great game that's afoot. And the thing that's changed in the last 2 years is twofold. One is actually watching that kind of transformational Kanchi culture just fuck it up almightily in ways I did not even anticipate. So that was a surprise. Of just how utterly like onion article satire, but actually happening in real life. That's all becoming in like the post Burning Man neo hippie emergence, which I didn't even know was a thing until like 6 months ago when I got dragged to a sound bath in San Francisco. I'm like, oh, what is this? Like, who are you guys? Cause like Burning Man used to be like crazy punk rock, this deliberately anti hippie and anti any sense of piety or self-seriousness, you know, and now we're getting the emergence of this whole mutation. It's the thing, I mean, it's what, you know, butters J.P. Sears bread, you know, and to his credit, he's seeing it and mocking it appropriately. But there's that, so that was a super surprise as to how quickly we are just repeating, like absolutely chapter and verse, all the sins of the hippie baby boomer generation without any self-awareness that these are the trends. And then the other is just the acceleration of, or the compression of timeline on X risk and consequence globally. So the destabilization of civil society in conjunction with the, you know, just external, challenges and perturbances. Those two things have kind of put us in what feels like a meaningly more urgent place. And it's the time has gone from encouraging nudges if you want to tug on the threads and follow them to also, and actually guys, the hour is late and the stakes are high and we get one crack at this. So let's get super clear on what we have to do next.
Those two things seem to be related to me. It's like the existential risks, but as long as they're not happening right on your doorstep, and then the ecstatic technologies, which tend to produce giant egos if left unchecked, you know, and people are coming out of Burning Man or these communities thinking that they are the next coming of Christ or that they are here saving the world while they're just, you know, drinking their pumpkin spice lattes or whatever. But because they're so far removed from these existential risks, but they're still aware of them, it's like those two things reinforce each other, you know? The problems yeah. over there and the ego over here. Does that sure. make sense?
I mean, yeah, it's basically spiritual bypassing overlaid on global crisis. And so if I have a choice, particularly, you know, I think Jordan Peterson, you know, labeled psychedelics quite well of just beware unearned wisdom. He might've been quoting Jung. But that idea of the unearned wisdom that is so easy to get, you know, so don't, it's not even just psychedelics, throw in cannabis, throw in polyamory, throw in, you know, the kind of Kanchi culture stuff, the sort of Tuluminati meets Bali meets, you know, Marin and Encinitas Boulder, you know, circuit, and then throw in the high-enders in New York, Tokyo, London, everywhere else, who are also playing this game of Ibiza and, you know, everything. Like, there's this whole circuit where you can check out into the Bliss Express, and it's way more pleasant. It's infinitely distracting and ultimately feels like the Hotel California. And so the question is literally at what point does anybody just like disconnect from that teat and go, whoa, okay, that was interesting, amazing, beautiful, profound and utterly banal at the same time. And now I must do my dharma. Now I have to do what I must. And that is antithetical to the postmodern personal growth relativistic perspective of I get to do whatever I want as long as I speak my truth, as long as what's true for me, as long as what's good for me. And it's back to that missing cherry on top of Maslow's pyramid. Self-transformation is that moment. You know, I always think of like in the Old Testament, there's Jonah, you know, like, and he, you know, that's the one that Joseph Campbell incorporated with the belly of the whale idea. But like, what happens when you're given your mandate and you try and duck it? And he's like, nah, I'm a successful businessman. I got shit to do. I don't want to go save Nineveh, you know, and then he tries to flee from it until he is consumed, devoured, written off for lost. And then and only then does he accept the burden of the gift. You know, New Testament is like Jesus going to those dudes fishing in the Sea of Galilee and they got their new nets and their new boats. And they're like, hey, we, you know, we got to pay these back. We're going to go fishing. He's like, no, man, you like put down your nets and come and be fishers of men. And so that moment, and there's, you know, every tradition has a version of it, but like that moment in Campbell's hero's journey, which is when do we accept the yoke? And as long as there's Instagram, as long as there's the next trip, as long as there's the next diversion or distraction, the answer is as far away from now as possible, instead of as soon as I get the original mandate.
Yeah. I really wonder if there's a necessity that we kind of capture all of these old narratives, especially what we're inheriting from the baby boomers in kind of the vlog new culture. Like we memeify and capture it now so that we can discuss it and memeify it and move on. And I feel like that's kind of what's happened with the intellectual dark web. Like now there's this big response from this social justice warrior lefty kind of thing. And now there's this giant conversation happening on the other side, which is super interesting. And I mean, not to say they're doing everything right on their side, but like this sort of back and forth of memifying and discussing and then processing and moving to the next stage. Like, I wonder if this all needs to happen in our sort of generation, all of the old memes, all of the old stories.
So say that again in a different language. So just use, if you can use some specific examples, then I'll be able to track you.
Sure. So let's use the boomers from the 60s as an example. Like you said, there's kind of this recycling of the mistakes and the same narratives happening now with the millennials. And part of me wonders if it has to be, those lessons cannot be learned by this generation until they've processed it through their memes and their methods of sense making.
Interesting. Okay, got it. Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting because, again, I think I was just reading a piece on that generation. And I mean, of course, full hat tip, you know, to our Dharma aunts and uncles, like for those folks, for, you know, Anne and Sasha Shulgin and Ken and Faye Kesey and, you know, Alice and Laura Huxley and, you know, and Alex and Allison Gray and so many people that forged the trail that even allowed us to go down it. You know, absolute hat tip. And that sense of self-reference that earned them the name, the me generation, was absolutely passed on to their kids. And that's what I was joking about with like the mini me generation, yeah. because there's a sense where, there's nothing new under the sun. And on the one hand, it's a truism that everybody has to go live their own experiences and learn their own lessons. The flip side is there's nothing new under the sun, and we don't have the luxury right now, I believe, and this is just a foundational position, I don't believe we have the luxury or the time to bumble through this one. I feel like these tools are here in our lives, and people can assign, you know, sort of supernatural or paranormal reasons, like the vine ayahuasca came alive, like the Tibetan Dharma had to come to the West. You know, like there's agency to it. I don't think you even need to go there. You can just say, this is the mutations of culture and here we are, but we have these tools now. But if you take what were the trends in the 60s, there's almost every single one of them has a one-to-one analog right now. You take like neo-Marxist critique of the capitalist system back then, you know, Students for Democratic Society, that kind of stuff. And you've got blockchain and crypto now, critiquing late stage capitalism. Talk about free love then with the advent of the pill and that kind of stuff. And we've got polyamory now. Talk about LSD and turning on the world then. You've got ayahuasca and DMT now, right? You talk about cults and gurus gone wrong with Manson and Osho and Jim Jones and those. And you've not, and we've got Instagram influencers, followers, cults of personality and self-help gurus now. So pretty, we've got the, you know, you've got the war in Vietnam and the anti-war movement. We've got Afghanistan and Iraq. You've got civil rights back then. We've got social justice warriorhood now and Black Lives Matter. Every single one of these, right, has their direct and unique parallel. And there are tons of lessons learned. I mean, again, my training is as a historical anthropologist. So that's all I look, that's just how I see things. It's always like, what is going on right now? Who knows? Look back and see what's the longest track of precedence behind it you can identify, and then project forward. So in Robert Persig, the guy who wrote Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, he says, when you try to look where you're going, sometimes it's really hard to see. But if you look back to where you've been and you connect the dots pointing forward, sometimes they can show you where you're going. And that is 100% just like how that's my default setting. I can't help but see things that way. And when you do that to our current moment, you're like, oh, here's the fail points. Here's the fail points. It's merely a matter of time until those vectors go into the same ditches right where the old skid marks are. And so it's not that we're wrong or we're doing it badly. It's we're needed and we have to do it better. We have to make newer, more complex mistakes. Like there's going to be plenty of challenge, plenty. We have to earn the right to fail there, downfield, not right here, just when we laced up our boots.
Yeah. So well said. Yeah.
I think that I would really hope that people can learn their own lessons, but it seems that a part of it is kind of just environmental. Like I grew up during the collapse of the Soviet Union, so my experience of growing up was very different than people growing up in a very safe Western country, you know? I like the idea that things can just be fixed with technology or the government or some other person in power will figure it out or everything will be fine. Like I don't come with that kind of programming. So it's growing up in that environment, it's like when really shitty things happen, people either figure it out or they collapse.
Is there anything else we should discuss here?
Yeah, we've talked about sovereignty and personal responsibility and fixing our own trauma and all of this. But once we do that, how do we show up with others and how do we create community with others in a healthy and sovereign way?
Yeah, I mean, that is the million-dollar question. And honestly, like post-Stealing Fire, you kind of asked like what has shifted or unfolded since then. And it's literally that. It was seeing, like in some small way, the writing of that book further crystallized the emergence of that very community that we were writing about, because people could hold it up as an artifact and go, see, this is us, that's me, it's happening, it's on. And so post that, like the following 24 months, you know, and throw in Michael Pollan's book, throw in our general zeitgeist, all of it has just been accelerating. And what we noticed was the incredible challenge of creating basically post-conventional group flow or communitas or, you know, high-performing team community or organization where everybody drops their separateness and steps into some emergent coherence together. And the only places that I've seen, I mean, it's the places where, you know, we often wrote about, but like the places I've definitely seen it happen are things like special operations teams and professional sports teams. The Golden State Warriors are a kind of ready and easy example. And really, you know, and I think, you know, a couple of seasons ago, the Patriots like crazy come from behind a win in the Super Bowl where the fourth quarter was just a group flow state and nothing went wrong for them. They were clearly in mind meld. But what's really important about those, I mean, those are interesting, like, you know, aspirational examples. But if you think about it, they're also ruthlessly meritocratic, which is we're this incredible high-performing team that does this one in a million thing where all of our body minds drop and we merge into a seamless unit. And oh, by the way, if you're the odd one out that can't pull it, you're yanked nearly instantly and replaced by somebody better who can. And so that is it's a helpful aspirational example. It can be done, but then you bring it down into our community ethos or family or tribe, right? Where everybody's equal or we're all here no matter what and everybody's safe based on, even if you show your vulnerabilities or your lacks and things, which is gorgeous, beautiful and essential. How do we actually do that down here? I haven't seen a whole bunch of like repeatable examples of that. So it's tricky is the simple answer. Now that there's also the sense of, I think we actually have to own the dynamics and tendencies that arise when you combine peak state, shared peak states or communitas, right, with ecstasis, catharsis, basically the peak and the trauma and the healing and release. And you do that in a sort of triangle, right? It's the peak state is the inspiration, the catharsis is the integration, and then the community is the collaboration. And we're forever cycling along through that. And when you have those three in combination, you have the rise of cultic tendency. And to say, oh, our group is different, we don't. yeah, all those other ones, but ours isn't, is exactly what all of them have said. So I think denial or exceptionalism doesn't work. You have to say these things emerge when tribal primates get together, blow their minds, grieve, connect, and, you know, and really merge. That loss of egoic boundary is fucking problematic. And if you take like an anthropological or a comparative religious look at the origins of cults, right? Cultus in Latin just means to worship. So it's a neutral term. This is what we do when we get together, right? And praise and grieve together. That's cultus. And, you know, in the literature or in the historical record, there was a cult of Kali. There was a cult of Dionysus. There was an Orphic cult. There was a cult of Christianity until Emperor Constantine saw the light, right? All it meant was there was a community outside state sanction that was practicing these things. And that was the subjugation of the self to the lineage or to the tradition. So you show up, this is how we do it, right? And you are basically an anonymous participant in a much bigger, older, longer thing than you. So sit the fuck down, take a number, do as you're told, more or less. I mean, that's a gross reduction, but more or less, right? So subjugation of self to the lineage. In the 60s and 70s, we had this mutation where you had self-appointed God men and women outside of their lineage, but they kept that same thing up. And they said subjugation of self to me, right? Ronin, right? Self-appointed outside the lineage representative of the divine. And so we clearly, want to avoid that at all costs. It's massively problematic. But how do we do ethical cults where instead of having the subjugation of the self to anyone or anything, we actually have the deep honoring and even amplification of individual sovereignty? And at the same time, create the conditions for highly generative co-emergence and creation. So in some respects, like, that's our nut to crack. And what I've noticed is that, I'm curious as, you know, if this is true in your guys' experience or not as well, but what I've been seeing is a lot of unstable elements of, like, highly awake, alive people. They come together, they start swapping their notes. They tell their stories. This is how I got to here. This is what I feel my life's work is. You name it, that kind of stuff. And there's high resonance. And people are like, woohoo, me too. And like, holy shit. And it might even go a step further, not just affinity and we've walked similar roads, but affinity and we share the same vision. We've had downloads. We've done whatever we've done. And we believe we're seeing the same future. And not only that, but your puzzle pieces are distinct but complementary to my puzzle pieces. And we start laying them down and people are like, oh shit, like I've got this superpower and you got that superpower and I know how to do this and you know how to do that. And it's like, oh my God, maybe we're the Wonder Twins. Maybe we're the superheroes we've all been waiting for. Like, this is it. And then, you know, plans to buy land in, you know, Big Sur or the mountains or some other random island. And we're going to do a community and we're going to do all this stuff. And oh, by the way, what do we do before the world ends? I know, we'll be like us. We'll do workshops teaching other people how to wake up like we are. Right. And so like that is fucking, if I had a nickel for every one of those. Right. And yet at the same time, I also have experienced so many of these where you get to that maximum peak of enthusiasm, sense of destiny, sense of this is unfolding according to plan. I'm not alone and I don't have to carry my burden by myself. Like all that beautiful, beautiful shit. And then someone has to make a decision as to who strokes the check, who's in charge, what the agenda is, what it's not, and employs 3D waking state, Monday morning, money, power, agency, decisions, control, responsibility, accountability. And then suddenly everybody pulls back. And you now are kind of looking at each other a little bit sideways, like, whoa, I thought you were awakened Jedi. And now I'm beginning to think I see some of your shadow. And now I step back and I create a little check in with my other people. And are we awake? And do we actually need to push those guys aside? Are they as awake as they think they're awake? And we end up basically in unscripted tantra, where now the question is can we see each other's light from each other's light? And we actually are truly lifting each other up into those heightened states of both individual and collective performance? Or do we end up collapsing and then only seeing each other's shadow from each other's shadow? And it becomes, there's a huge burden, because it's like, let's just say you're all thought leaders, you're all people who have been breaking trail and you've all been leading some version of a community behind you. And then you find each other, right? The leader of leaders. And you're like, this is our core. This is what I've been waiting for. And we all have wounds, right? We have wounds of trying to live our Dharma for as long as we've been trying to live it. Everybody who hasn't understood us, every career decision, every relationship failure, every sense of loneliness, every sense of fear, uncertainty of having to walk this path to now. And we're like, oh yeah, here's all my puzzle pieces. And it's like, wait a second. Am I absolutely sure that my hard-earned pieces are going to be seen, loved, respected, met? Am I absolutely sure we're still looking at the same picture? Because you said a few things back there. I'm really not sure your Eden's my Eden, right? I mean, everybody says, let's live in Eden. Everyone's like, fuck yeah. You actually start trying to build it, blueprint it, lay out the streets, and it gets way more complicated. That was George Martin's number one thing about Game of Thrones. That's why he loved the end of Lord of the Rings. Because at the end of the Lord of the Rings is the scouring of the Shire, like Frodo and Sam come back and the place is torched by orcs. And he's like, yeah, see, it's not just happily ever after. And George Martin was critical. You know, that was his whole point about Westeros, was like, winning the Iron Throne is one thing, ruling from it is way harder. And so how do we do this when we end up torn between glimpsing each other's light from each other's light versus unraveling when we get locked in each other's shadow? And that is the doorstep to tantra. And I don't mean like sexual erotic tantra. I just mean the place of relating to another, accepting all that's arising versus judging and separating, and being able to navigate the chapel perilous by being able to navigate, right? That was Philip K. Dick's term, like referring back to the Grail legends, right? The idea, like, once you're in there, only the pure of heart can make it through without getting lost or going mad. And we are really collectively right at the doorstep. And it's, you know, and there's this goofy thing where the Chapel Perilous, the place the Grail lives for the pure of heart, also has an inside wall with the Hotel California. And that piece, particularly for the psychedelic poly burner trancey scene, is massively problematic because you can show up at 9 or 10 in the evening and you all walk through the front door of the Chapel Perilous and it's gorgeous. It's knights and ladies, man. It's beautiful. You hang out till 2 a.m. and folks are bumping ketamine and on the jaggedy back end of their MDMA high. And you can check out anytime you want and you can never leave. And so we end up in an incredibly well-appointed, you know, bindies and feathers and sexy, sexy hell realm. And how we differentiate from that feels critical. And of course, how do you do co-creative emergent culture that needs this high discernment and really high stakes leadership formulated on experiences like the psychedelic experience, like any non-dual meditative, contemplative, erotic experience, you fill in the blank, that are inherently antinomian, meaning they are anti-authority. They are anti-deferring to something other than your own inner truth. And so we end up in these crazy shit shows where we need leadership and discernment. And yet the very thing we're trying to do involves the disappearance of those very liberating structures, provided we can trust each other enough to actually stay true to the code. And so that's where I honestly think, and I don't know how we do this, but like what I would recommend as a like anthropologist would be like, what you need is you need a code of fucking ethics. And you need a code of ethics that everybody is like blood oath, pinky swear, you know, we're committed to no matter what. And then I can relax if I know we've all signed up to live by the same code. And I know, and we have to, you know, develop trust by doing this, which would be, and if I'm out of line, if I'm out of integrity, I will acknowledge it and I will make reparations to the community, not what is happening a whole bunch right now, which is he said, she said. And that's not my truth. And I understand what you're saying. It's kind of like just super fucking passive aggressive, multi-perspectival, nonviolent communication shit show of this is my truth and fuck you. Because people just get burned out and tired really quickly of engaging that tar baby and quicksand. And then we're like, okay, this is not resolved, but I don't trust you anymore. And so we end up fragmenting again into increasing smaller circles. So how do we lean into this and commit to playing well? It's like a dojo, you know, like you bow onto the mat and you bow off. You don't storm off. You don't sulk off. And there's rules on how we engage learning combat together, like no cheap shots, no below the belts, no hitting with anger. You know, like we fully commit to playing, learning and training together, but there is a structure that supersedes how I feel that day, right? Or when I get triggered, how I choose to behave, what's a range of permissible response. So I know that's a fair whack, but this is a critical one. And I don't think we've figured out if other folks have, I'd love to hear about it, love to learn about it.
Yeah. It seems like a lot of people in the distributed governance decentralization movement are attempting to create a standard operating document, but they're completely lost in blockchain world and not looking at what people like you and Daniel and Jordan and other thinkers like you are talking about, like kind of the anthropology, the psychology, the all of the steps that society and individuals have to go through to get to a place where we can have productive, decentralized decision making. But it seems like that's what they want to do, whether that's what they're going after or not, like consciously, is to have a standard operating document for distributed governance.
Yeah, I mean, and I think we would kind of probably be able to feel it and sense it when someone comes up with it. And like some of the earlier DAO stack stuff and the DAO ideas of decentralized autonomous organizations, I was amazingly geeked and hopeful about, because I was like, oh shit, maybe this will do it. Maybe there's a tech structure that can support this consciousness emerging. Yeah. And then at least when I last checked into that world, it was, you know, some of the leading thinking was, you know, you have reputation and there's kind of crowdsource rankings, and the more successfully you're leading and backing certain votes on certain decisions, the more effectively weighted your you know, reputation rank becomes, and all of those kinds of things. So the idea of like good people making good decisions over time have more input. So it's not like base democracy and it's not representative democracy. It's sort of meritocratic, democratic, right? Reputation management. You're like, okay, that all sounds super cool, until you realize, oh shit, basically, if I get compounding advantage for winning, meaning I'm on the right side of a vote, then you're suddenly straight back to how many people can I persuade to vote with me in concert, which is no different than caucuses in the Senate. So the moment you have caucusing going on, you're right back to game theory, tribal monkeys rallying around, and you've got compounding advantage, rent-seeking behavior. If I win the rulemaking game, I get to make more rules that further perpetuate my advantage. So you get an increased consolidation of power up to and until the point where you have now such hegemonic control that all the fragmented competitors around you go, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Let's band together and create an alliance and knock the king off the hill. And you do the same fucking thing all over again. And so, and I mean, and again, if someone has moved it beyond that credibly, I'd love to learn about it, because that was the last time I checked in, and that was just like, oh guys, that's just silicone game theory. Yeah. There's not a structural improvement yet that I could see.
It seems that a lot of this kind of stuff breaks down just because of monkey behavior, and we can't really fix monkey behavior. Like our genome is what it is. So I wonder about historical examples of some sort of community decision-making working with checks and balances or whatever safeguards in place so that it doesn't turn into the bad version of the cult.
Well, I think it's different because of the scale and distribution of the internet. Now it's just like, that's the one thing that's different that makes this potentially not repeatable.
But monkeys are still going to be monkeys.
Yeah, I mean, one that inspired the founding fathers in America, but also inspired me just doing anthropological research, was the, you know, the Iroquois Confederacy, right? So the Iroquois Nation, I mean, that was the model for the Articles of Confederation that predated the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. So at first, it was the colonies were all kind of independent, you know, basically DAOs. It was like, what does a North American DAO look like that's not subject to the crown in England? And they modeled it on the Iroquois Confederacy, which was one of the larger, more sophisticated political organizations in indigenous North America. But there were a couple of things that happened. I mean, one is consensus could be reached, but there was also in many indigenous cultures, there's no attachment to timeliness. So consensus could be reached in 15 minutes. Somebody says the right thing. Nobody else says anything else, and it's clear and it's okay. We're done. It could take 10 days. And we don't live in those kind of time frames where whatever it takes, it took, right? We're living in hyper nano clock time. And so that is a trickier one to replicate now. Now, maybe some technology can help accelerate that. But when you see SJW critiques, when you see like someone just kick the stool out from an entire edifice that's been co-created in a day or a week or whatever about a critical decision, and someone goes, yeah, but what about that outgroup? Or what about that unheard voice? And the entire thing just disintegrates. And you're like, oh shit, man, this kind of weird coherence is fragile. And all it takes is a few people with sharp instruments to pop it, even as it, you know, slowly expands. But the other is the grandmothers on the Iroquois Council actually sat above the war chief. So if the war chief wanted to go to war, he had to go and sit in front of them. And their mandate was fundamentally different than a basically, you know, sociopathic male. And they said, hey, you can go and create a raid on the Huron. You can go and raid, right, some next door neighbor. However, you can't lose a single one of our boys. And so in a different from like Pyrrhic victories or like, oh, we had sustainable casualties or like they lost more than we lost, that kind of a thing. They're like, no. We're not doing that kind of disembodied thing. We're coming from like maternal wisdom. if you lose even one of our sons, we then have to go and avenge him again. And then we're going to lose another, we're going to lose more of our sons. And then that cycle never ends. So here's the deal, war chief, right? If you're going to go and do this, you answer to us and you have parameters that are fundamentally life affirming, not just dominator controller. And so, you know, is there the capacity for us to have, and I don't mean this in like a naive or sort of, I don't know, I mean, maybe it is naive, but I fantasize about a council of women elders. And Brett Weinstein, who's also friends with Daniel and Jordan, he and his wife, Heather Haining, are evolutionary biologists. And they make a really fascinating distinction, which is until societies cease to give power to young sexualized femininity and mistake that for feminine wisdom, and until they, and basically anytime a guy, particularly in patriarchal leadership or authority, has his will or his attention bent to the beautiful, sexual, and available from the feminine, right, and is ignoring the crone, is ignoring the grandmother, we're fucked. Like, that is dysfunctional, codependent patriarchy where everybody loses. Until there is an honoring both from the young girls, like, I might be the young and sexy thing right now, but I bow down to you, grandmother, who has been right in my shoes and traveled many more and is now no longer fertile, no longer has skin in this game of the monkey shit, right? That's also like the Manchurians in China. I mean, they ruled the dynasty for what, 2000 years? And they were eunuchs. And the whole point is they were eunuchs was so that they didn't have inheritance, Game of Thrones games to play. So eunuchs are stable and basically postmenopausal wise grandmother women are stable. And the rest of us are subject to extreme primate game theory. So what would that be like if we had a wise council? I mean, I could picture Pema Chodron, Alice Walker. Like, there's a list of women like grandmother wisdom who hold it down and aren't playing any ego games. And what would our world, what would communities be like? Where we had something like that as a check and balance to our other impulses and also and sort of lesser forms of expressing power.
Grandma Council.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. Like, we have these threads that keep coming up, and that's one of the like the memes or ideas that keeps coming up in the last couple of days, grandma wisdom. Mm-hmm. Our society needs grandma wisdom.
Yeah, because it's back to the homegrown humans, which is like there's nothing new under the sun. And no matter how fancy pants our explanations or how much our hair on fire, psychedelic or mystical experiences appear to be, like, oh, wow, I was back in the back of dimensions and I translated to this other fucking planet in this galaxy. And then these star beings told me this and my god angel said the other. And you're like, yeah, and right. The Hopi grandmothers, you know, their query was always, does it grow corn? Does it grow corn? Do you, when you show up back in these little skins of ours, back in these incredibly brief lives of ours, what you gonna do about it? You know, and does it help the least of our brothers and sisters? And that filter whittles out an awful lot of the pretty lights.
Yeah, actually, we'd love to pick your brain on the grandmotherly wise women that we could have on our show in the future.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Mm. Any suggestions?
Well, I mean, the simplest is my life partner. She's not in the grandmother frame yet, but she is for sure in that post-conventional wise wisdom. So there's very little I have to say that's not originated and sourced from her take on it. And I just don't know what, you know, then there's obviously like known public personalities, but I would say for sure Pema Chodron and Alice Walker, if they're remotely available, they are some of the, because like all of their wisdom and insight is always stop seeking to escape, stop seeking to transcend, right? Come back full circle, be with the pain, be with the grief, be with the reality and with the joy, right? Be with all of it. And for me, for quite some time, because I mean, like, I'm obviously like super agentic ascendant masculine. For me, that's the only place I feel comfortable. That's the only place I feel like I can actually exhale is when somebody's in court, like actually recognizing life as it is instead of telling some shaggy dog story about how it could be if you only did this, that, or the other, or followed me here. And so that kind of full circle wisdom of coming back into utterly ordinary life, transformed, that to me feels the legit place for us to make a stand. And everything else is just like, you're just not done yet. Like anybody who's wearing Burning Man clothes on their fucking street clothes, anybody who's like rocking bindis on, you know, weekdays, you're like, nice try. You know, whatever ego you thought you got rid of is still there nudging you to do that shit. So that's it. We're not done until we're utterly ordinary again.
Jamie, thank you. Let's do this again. This has been awesome. This has been perfect for everything we've talked about in the last several months. So this is great. Thank you.
Beautiful. Be well, guys.
All right, that's it for our episode with Jamie Wheel. To get all the links and show notes, go to futurethinkers.org/100.
And if you want to stay up to date with our latest episodes, blog posts, or news from Future Thinkers, join our mailing list at futurethinkers.org/mailing-list. To meet like-minded people, join our Future Thinkers Discord community. Go to futurethinkers.org/discord.
Check out our new course in personal evolution. Part one is on cultivating sovereignty and is designed to support you in developing more clarity about your direction and purpose in life, making better decisions, and having more agency to live your life on your own terms.
Part two is on integrating the shadow and is designed to support you in overcoming nihilism and tapping into an inner source of energy, creativity, and wisdom to make meaningful progress towards actualizing your full potential. To learn more, go to courses.futurethinkers.org. Don't forget to subscribe and hit the bell icon to get notified of new videos. You can also follow us on social media to stay connected. If you'd like to get a t-shirt like the new Make America Think Again, go to futurethinkers.org/store. If you like what we do and you want to help us make more podcasts and videos, consider donating or becoming a patron at futurethinkers.org/support. Also visit our sponsor Qualia and use the coupon code FUTURE to get 10% off your purchase.